Knowing how to speak and understand a new language can be an invaluable tool when traveling, meeting new friends, or just even to master a new skill. But it's not always simple when you're bogged down by textbooks and structure classes. That's why so many people trust Rosetta Stone. Rosetta Stone is the most trusted language learning program, available on desktop or as an app. It truly immerses you in the language you want to learn, like Spanish, French, Italian, Chinese, and more. You won't just be studying English translations. The Rosetta Stone intuitive process helps you pick up a language naturally, first with words, then phrases, then sentences. Don't put off learning that language. There's no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. Visit rosettastone.com/rs10. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/rs10 today.
What was increasingly clear that this was would be a fun book was just like the growing number of just like insane tales that you'd hear from former employees and whatnot about private jets, and it was just sort of like they became the apotheosis of like everything concerning in Silicon Valley.
There's such mass delusion, like really sanctioned recklessness throughout. I mean, one of the sad aspects of, I think, this story is, you know, not to take any credit away from Adam for the rise and for sort of running this company into the ground, Adam Neumann, the CEO. But I feel like there are few people who could have built the company that Adam Neumann did, inspired all these people. I mean, he was a visionary. You can't take that away from him. He had this ability to raise money, to get people to follow him. He also was completely reckless.
You know, it was this emperor's new clothes moment in 2019 where people finally saw it for what it was, and it all kind of crumbled in a really dramatic, journalistically engaging way. This wasn't just about WeWork and a charismatic entrepreneur, Adam Neumann. This is about how the financial system and the financial structure created and enabled this kind of like crazy thing to become the country's most valuable startup.
It is my pleasure to welcome to Yang Speaks Elliot Brown and Maureen Farrell, both ace business journalists who just put out this book, The Cult of We. Welcome to the podcast, Elliot and Maureen.
Thanks for having us.
Happy to be here.
So first, I want to get a little bit of the backdrop for each of you. You're both business journalists. And how long have you been doing what you've been doing? How did you get into this line of work? Because I know there are a lot of people that love business, love writing, but I know it's very, very hard to do what you do.
I'll start. I kind of stumbled into business journalism. After college, I worked at a think tank and didn't really know what I wanted to do. Then I went to J school. I always wanted to get into journalism, but not necessarily business. My only class in college on business was Marxism. That was as close as I got to economics ever. And the first job that kind of came available was in New York. It was covering mergers and acquisitions. And I admittedly went into the interview not really quite knowing what a merger was. Somehow got the job and really then kind of just learned on the job and started to see, I always had kind of wanted to do more politics and really started to see that business tells you about politics and the world at large in a way that I hadn't anticipated. And I became kind of hooked on business journalism from there.
Wow. I think you dodged a bullet, Maureen. I think that business journalism might have an edge over political journalism. Elliot, how about you?
Not too dissimilar a story. I took one econ class in college that wasn't Marxism. And I was really interested in real estate. And so started writing about that when I got to New York and right after college at the New York Sun and then the New York Observer. It was more political in terms of what I covered. It was about sort of fights over housing and development. But then I went to the Wall Street Journal because I wanted a job that, you know, wasn't at the New York Observer after a while. And the job there was business. And I sort of learned what loans were and debt was. And I guess I always knew how to use an Excel sheet better than sort of the average political reporter. So I enjoy it. It's kind of fun. It doesn't take there's a lot of differences with political journalism.
Look at this. Elliot just managed to throw his former employer and the numeracy of other reporters under the bus.
I like the Observer, but yes, I didn't even get into the owner at the time, which was...
They didn't deserve you, Elliot. No, I'm kidding. So you both wrote this incredible book, The Cult of We, about WeWork, about Adam Neumann, about this incredible 21st century emblem of entrepreneurship. How did this book germinate and come about, and how the heck did you all decide to team up on it? Like, were you both reporting on WeWork and then you looked across the desk at each other and were like, hey, we're gonna write a book together, like, you know? Like, how does this happen?
So that's essentially the short version. I was writing on WeWork as a real estate reporter for years, starting in, I first met Adam Neumann in 2013, back when they were this little tiny company in Lower Manhattan with a few leases. Then, you know, kind of just followed them. It was essentially the same story the whole way through for a while, which was, why is this real estate company valued so high?
Why 20 indeed, Elliot? when did you start asking that question?
Pretty soon. So at first it was like, wow, why this guy's really interesting and kind of bouncing off the walls with energy, and co-working is a fast growing trend. That's sort of interesting. But then I learned their valuation, and it was $1.5 billion. And so that was 2014 that I learned that, I guess. And that from there through 2019 was sort of the obsession, might say unhealthy obsession on my end. As things got crazier, then Maureen can sort of fill in, but she came along too.
I think in 2018 at some point, maybe even 2017, I covered IPOs for the Journal. So it was always in the small cohort of companies, Airbnb, Uber, that were the most interesting companies to cover that were eventually going to go public. So I would look at it from that vantage point. And yeah, in 2018, I also wound up covering SoftBank a lot, the Japanese conglomerate that was just becoming a bigger and bigger investor in startups. So Elliot and I teamed up a little bit on stories about both of them in 2018, and then much more as 2019. And then by the time the IPO was falling apart, I mean, we were working on stories like round the clock and, you know, talking like a dozen times a day about like what was going to happen. And, you know, around the time when Elliot had been, I think, thinking about this for a while, but over the last week or so before Adam Neumann resigned, we were like, this could be a really interesting book. And it came together very quickly after that.
So you came into the story because, everyone thought that they were going to IPO, and then you were like, okay, you know, unicorn IPOing, that's cool. And then it's like, wait a minute. They start talking to Elliot. Elliot's like, hey, I think there's some problems over there at WeWork. Now, I can tell you all about, I, like most other people, heard about WeWork during the unicorn days. And I also had a chin-scratching moment being like, how are they worth billions and billions of dollars? And here was my experience with Elliot, which will entertain the heck out of you, is that I was actually operating out of a Regis office space in the mid-2000s. So for those of you listening to this who don't know what that is, Regis is a co-working space for small businesses. You know, if you don't want to have a long-term lease, you could sign up for their office space. They have like supplies, they charge you for phone lines, you have a fancy mailing address. So I was part of a small software company that operated out of a Regis for several years, from 2002 to 2005. And so then when you see WeWork with this crazy valuation, I was like, wait a minute, like that business existed.
And, you know, it not only did it exist, but it had almost the exact same story happen to it, because in 1999, it told the world and 2000 that it was part of the dot-com boom because they had broadband that went there, and something else about the future of office space, and they tried to get a valuation like a tech company, and then it all imploded. So it was a very similar story.
I'll tell you another data point I had that I was like, okay, that company's going to be like a house of cards that falls apart. Was a friend of mine said to me that he was recruited to work in a WeWork Detroit. And he said that WeWork Detroit had opened up and no one wanted to pay the rates that they were charging. And if you've been to Detroit, you know that the main thing that Detroit has right now is millions of empty offices, shall we say. Like millions of, not millions is an exaggeration, thousands of really, really inexpensive, accessible office spaces in the city of Detroit. So when I heard that, I was like, why on earth would WeWork expand to Detroit? And then the fact that they were having a lot of trouble filling that space, I was like, oh man, like there's something really, really, really over-aggressive going on out of that company. And I might have heard this story around 2018 or so.
Yeah, I think that was, you know, like as someone watching the rise, I was constantly wondering at like these new markets. It's like, because, you know, their goal was to keep doubling revenue every year. And there's only so many people that want to WeWork in New York. And so they would have to, yeah, keep expanding to these random markets that I think when everything fell apart, they looked at and they're like, why are we in Kansas City? But then sort of the other thing, I guess, to mention about what was increasingly clear that this was a would be a fun book was just like, the growing number of just like insane tales that you'd hear from former employees and whatnot about private jets, and it was just sort of like they became the apotheosis of like everything concerning in Silicon Valley. And you'd always hear about, I was covering startups at the time, and by 2018 and 19, and the concerning trends were like founders taking out money and like companies spending way, you know, more than they have, and like, I don't know, founder control, where the founder just has, no restraint and does things that don't support the business and pays for their hobbies. And like Adam was doing all of these things and, you know, with a lot of tequila and pot smoke to boot.
I think that was one of the most striking aspects of this story. And they should make a movie out of this or a documentary. Has anyone optioned this thing?
They did. They're actually making one right now. They optioned our book, but they're making, they've moved forward with a different one that Jared Leto and Anne Hathaway are playing Adam and Rebecca Newman.
No.
Yes.
We briefly had Nicholas Braun, so cousin Greg from Succession, was sort of tagged to play Adam, but it didn't work out in the end.
And we thought he was awesome.
No.
Well, he has the height because Adam's really tall. Nicholas Braun's really tall. Jared Leto less tall. though I'm into it. So what you're saying is that there's like a competing documentary. What this reminds me of is like Firefest, where there were like two Firefest documentaries. Is that what's happening?
Completely. That's what happened. So yeah, it was Apple TV is filming literally right now, and the Daily Mail, and they optioned a podcast by Wondery. And then, yeah, we briefly sort of had a dalliance with Amazon, but it didn't have, you know, they aren't filming now, so.
This podcast is sponsored by Helix Sleep. I have always been a mattress guy. I thought if you're going to spend 8 hours doing something, you should pay attention to what you're doing it on. That's why I love the Helix Sleep product. It is made for me. I am someone who sleeps on my back. I do not sleep hot. I like a firm mattress. And so when I took the Helix Sleep quiz, I wound up with a Helix Dawn model. And it's been fantastic, not just for me, but for my kids who seek it out of the entire house. Don't want to take my word for it? Helix has been awarded the number one mattress pick by GQ and Wired magazine, and they have a 100-night free trial and 10 to 15 year warranties baked in. That's confidence in your product. And if you get on a Helix Sleep mattress, you will see why they are so confident. Helix is offering 20% off all mattress orders and two free pillows for our listeners.
Go to helixsleep.com/yang and use code HELIXPARTNER20. This is their best offer yet, and it won't last long. With Helix, better sleep starts now.
So fun. So as journalists, and I don't know the answer to this, I'm just curious. So when you two are co-reporting feverishly during the run-up to the IPO in 2019, and just like tales of excess and lunacy are coming out, that you're looking at each other, being like, talking to dozens of people. So when did you decide to come together on the book?
It was in the days right around when he was about to leave. He was getting pushed out. I mean, the IPO had fallen apart, and it was just, the story just got crazier and crazier. But essentially, when we started hearing, and Elliot wrote this really groundbreaking story. This was from his years of reporting about him boarding about all his excesses, about like boarding a plane to Israel and leaving a marijuana box on the plane, and the pilot was taken in by the police shortly after that for many reasons, but very much Elliot's story was part of it. Adam Neumann was pushed out, and it was unfathomable. And Elliot could speak more to that, but I mean, we just couldn't, it happened so quickly. It was so crazy. And we were, you know, it just felt like you were in the middle of like a movie kind of and we heard, one funny thing was like, we heard there was this coup coming to get Adam out. So we were trying to report the coup and figure it out. And Mike Isaac at the New York Times had just written a book on Uber called Super Pumped. It had come out a while ago, but I was partway through it. And Elliot kept on saying, just get to the coup part. Like, this is what's happening this weekend. You got to read the coup chapter. It's a little different, but it felt like, yeah.
So then at that point you said, we should totally write a book about this. And one of my questions really is, it seemed like you guys had hundreds and hundreds of interviews, probably hundreds of pages of notes. Like, what's the process between when you say, hey, we should write a book, and then Elliot's like, oh, good, because I've been doing research on these guys for five or 6 years. You know, like, what happens next? How did you divide the labor? Because I've now written a few books myself, and like, I don't know how the co-authorship process even works.
Yeah, it was super collaborative. So, you know, without boring people too much, I mean, it was like, you know, for the first few months after we agreed to do it, we were still, hadn't taken leave yet at the Journal, and we're working on a big year-end piece that would like clearly dovetail well with the book, where we were just talking to tons of people about the aftermath and sort of, you know, learning more to dig into the company. So that was sort of chunk one. And then chunk two was taking leave and then like laying out the arc of the book and figuring out who we needed to talk to. And so we would just divide up who to talk to. And then we would just constantly talk with each other about what are we going to ask this person? What are we going to say? So yeah. And then, you know, we eventually started writing. And that was, we kind of traded off chapters, but would talk about the structure of a chapter before we'd each do it. And then we'd kind of trade and then both, you know, go through with the other's writing.
Wow. You guys really must get along famously.
It's kind of incredible. Yeah. That we fight over shared documents and a few too many of those, but there's not that much tension, which is kind of a new world record for me.
That is remarkable, particularly given how petty I get over my own prose. Like, I wrote something and then someone changes a word, I'd be like, why did you change that word?
I heard a lot of people, I don't know if you think this, Andrew, but a number of our colleagues and other friends who'd written books were like, it gets really lonely. You're like in this whole world and you're kind of alone in it. So I thought, I mean, it was just really fun. Like every day we were finding out new things. And, you know, as much as my husband cared about the book, which he did, like he might not want to talk about it like all day long. So it was like just so much fun to talk about it.
It was also good to have the motivation of, you know, if it were just me, I could be like, well, I don't need to do this now. You know, I'd rather sit around and hit refresh on Twitter. But it's like, but that's sort of the general, you know, status quo. But like having Maureen there, it's like, I'd be letting down her whole family if I procrastinate. So
my children would actually call Elliot, which is another story, but my younger daughter would be like, I want to talk to Elliot on FaceTime. She was kind of obsessed with him.
So the book is endlessly entertaining. It's very hard to put down. You know, you want to see what happens next. One of the things I was trying to figure out is, like, what do you think, like, the big themes or lessons or takeaways from the book are? I had my own. And for those of you listening to this or someone listening to this who aren't as familiar with the WeWork story, like, go ahead and someone give, like, a, you know, like, the 60-second version. It's like, you know, it's like the rise and fall of an entrepreneur. It's like excesses of a particular era. It's, you know, it's a business parable. It's the power of people to kind of deny certain realities in the face of a particular type of culture. How would you actually describe the story that you spent now at this point years painstakingly documenting?
You took away all of the main takeaways. That was very good. It was like, wow. You know, we hope people would take away a lot of those lessons. So, the short version is a, you know, baby clothes entrepreneur, changed jobs to found a real estate company, convinced the whole investment world that it was a disruptive tech startup, raised $10 billion, and then, you know, it was this emperor's new clothes moment in 2019 where people finally saw it for what it was, and it all kind of crumbled in a really dramatic, journalistically engaging way. I think we both thought one of the most important tales to tell here was that the financial, this wasn't just about WeWork and a charismatic entrepreneur, Adam Neumann. This is about how the financial system and the financial structure created and enabled this kind of like crazy thing to become the country's most valuable startup. But it was just a real mirage. So we wanted to tell that tale.
Yeah, there's such mass delusion, like really sanctioned recklessness throughout. I mean, one of the sad aspects of, I think, this story is, you know, not to take any credit away from Adam for the rise and for sort of running this company into the ground, Adam Neumann, the CEO. But I mean, he was very much enabled. I feel like there are few people who could have built the company that Adam Neumann did, inspired all these people. I mean, he was a visionary. You can't take that away from him. He had this ability to raise money, to get people to follow him. He also was completely reckless, but there was like, there should have been checks and balances on his recklessness. And it's sort of sad that the system didn't work in that way. Like, could he have built this to great heights? And if people were willing to stand up to him, could we have this company now? Like, could people, I mean, he made all these young people sort of believe in the power of building this company. I think there was something inspiring, and there's such disillusionment with so many of the people who work there.
You know, it's one reason I really liked the book is that I think you were balanced in this way. Like, you know, that like what you just said, Maureen, about the fact that, look, this is a genuine visionary, genuinely talented entrepreneur, and certainly an incredible salesperson. Like, I mean, there's some like real, there's some real talents and skills in here. And in different circumstances with different people and different teams around him, and some of the institutional checks that you would expect to be there, then WeWork could be an extraordinarily positive, impactful company right now. You know, like that had some of its excesses moderated. I think at least one of the investors was like, "Well, after it becomes public, someone's going to rein this guy in," which was kind of a funny sentiment. But, you know, I think that you were, as far as I could tell, like quite balanced and appropriate. I thought it was an extraordinarily important detail that Adam was dyslexic, because there are so many world-class entrepreneurs that are dyslexic. I don't know if you both know this. But I think like half of Shark Tank is dyslexic.
That's interesting.
Damon John, Barbara Corcoran, both dyslexic. There are so many hyper talented entrepreneurs who struggled in school and developed these other capacities that enabled them to do things in startups and the business world.
That's fascinating. So I only had one other data point that I guess I probably shouldn't name because I never confirmed it. But yeah, it was another large unicorn CEO someone else was like, you should look into if this is a real thing. And
it's a thing. You all should know.
Here we are.
Yeah. certainly entrepreneurs having a higher preponderance of dyslexia than the general population. Is very much a reality. And one of the things that I struggled with too reading this, and this is going to be me confiding in you both a little bit, because this is not something that most people would experience reading this book. But I ran for president.
First interview where this has come up.
and there were so many elements of just needing to really believe in a way that draws other people in and drives an organization forward. And I've seen that in the business and entrepreneurship space. I've seen that in the political space. I've lived a version of that in the political space. And one of the things I was trying to figure out reading this book was how I felt about Adam. Certainly you can say that there are a lot of people around him where you were like, they just didn't do their jobs. someone needed to do a better job, especially people that were financing the company or people on the board. I mean, like the folks who were around him. And this is one of the reasons why I struggled with this, is check this out. So there is, and this is one of the things that you question in the book, really, which is this deference to the founder. Where a practice has changed in startups, where it used to be that if I started a company, then I had certain abilities, but I probably wouldn't be an effective CEO of a very large organization because there's a lot of process there, a lot of regulation there. And so investors would bring in a professional CEO, essentially. It's like adult supervision or like adult replacement. And then the visionary builder would then step aside and let the CEO take his or her company, generally a him in these contexts, unfortunately, like to maturation. And then there's been this new set of thinking that that a founder can like go from A to Z, where Mark Zuckerberg very famously turned down $1 billion acquisition offers for Facebook, and people thought he was crazy. And then now that company is worth almost $1 trillion or $1 trillion. And so there's thinking now that, like, well, there's actually something special to the founder and the vision. And if you had a professional manager in there, they would screw it up. And so Adam Neumann benefited from that founder deference. And it seems like the school of thought has kind of gone back and forth a little bit. And so I was struggling to think about which one I felt more strongly about. Like, does the person that originated the company and has a vision, like, sometimes they're the person that can lead the thing for decades to greater heights. And then in other cases, they're not. There probably isn't a rule there. It's probably that, it depends upon the individual.
Yeah, no, that hits on, that's really fascinating. So thanks for, I was going to ask you about sort of how you felt about this founder control, because it is this, it's pretty undeniable that you just go down the list of the most valuable companies, and they all had or have a founder that did a huge amount of the lifting to get to these, trillion-dollar market caps. On the other hand, a lot of this is born out of the mythology of Steve Jobs and Jeff Bezos being these omnipotent beings or above mortal, immortal. But one thing I like to point out is neither of those two people had founder control. So Steve Jobs was kicked out of his company and came back, and it all worked out in the end. And then Jeff Bezos just owns 40% of the stock. or owned 40% of the stock, and, you know, was doing a job that the board liked. So I guess, you know, one thing I wonder is there's the mythology of the founder and love of the concept of the visionary founder. And clearly, you know, there's something to that. But then why do you need to give them 100% of control? Like, I think that is just a product of the market. And that's like how the venture capital market has, you know, decided to conduct itself, because investors want to get in a deal. And so they'll be like, okay, I'll give you the keys to the car. And like, to me, it's like, this is the obvious manifestation. WeWork is like the obvious result of some of that. Like, how you're going to give people billions of dollars and full control, and like, you don't expect this to happen at some point?
Yeah, there's no checks put on. And it's like, I mean, Adam, it was to the extreme, but within so many of these companies now, it's like take it or leave it. And the venture capitalists don't want to be seen as founder. They want to be founder friendly, that to get into every deal that they want. It's like, yeah, the pendulum is swung. Even if you believe that there are founders who
it's a bargaining power thing. It's a bargaining power thing.
Completely.
So I'm going to again, you have my personal experience in this, where our system right now like trains a lot of people to be bankers, consultants, lawyers. I was a corporate lawyer myself briefly. And I certainly law is probably the most negative version because it's like, what are the rules? Comply. There's like a culture of propriety around this stuff. And then there's like the entrepreneur who often does have like, and you can frame it as vision. Vision, I think, is a very positive connotation. And then you can frame it as like a little bit of crazy, which has a negative connotation. Obviously, like, no one likes crazy. But like I'd say most of the talented entrepreneurs that I know, and I know dozens of entrepreneurs, include like hundreds of successful entrepreneurs, like there is a sort of set of traits that they have, that management consultant, does not have, or that the corporate lawyer that I used to be does not have. It's one reason why I left the law so quickly, is that I actually saw myself getting rewired and retrained in ways that I did not think were good for my happiness as a human being, for one, but also, like, you know, so the easy answer is to say, well, there's a balance, like, you know, you want to have a founder, and then you want some people around them to be you might want to ease up or show some restraint. I think in the case of WeWork, two things stood out to me. One is that I was shocked, because I did not know this, I was shocked at how much money Adam was able to both enjoy personally and retain afterwards, because most of like the colossal implosions that I'm familiar with left the founder in much less wealth.
Sub-billionaire.
yeah, sub-billionaire. It's like, ordinarily, if it implodes, like, you know, you're not on top of the world. I was like, wow, like, it's incredible, like the level of wealth that Adam and his family got out of a company that most people now see as something of a mirage, to what you'd said before, Elliot. So that was one thing, was like, I hadn't seen that before. But the other thought was that when he raised all this money, and they were looking at doing some things like buying properties, or things that would have stood up, you know what I mean? And I guess they were trying to grow the revenue, but I thought to myself, wow, they just like, or I think there was a period when they were like looking at buying Regis or HQ or one of those. I was like, wow, if they'd done that, that would have been great.
This is financially wonky, but at that point, they were actually the same size as Regis, but worth 10 times as much. Maybe it was five times, but so they thought like, well, why don't we just buy this company that has just as much or even more revenue than us, and we can just pay a small percentage of our company to do it, because the market is so crazy.
And they totally should have done that. So that was one thing that stood out to me. I was like, because it reminds me, and this is one of the things that I'm concerned about. I'm concerned about on several levels. So I'm 46 years old. And the first time I started a .com was 2000. was like the first bubble 21 years ago. Now, most people who are out there in the world don't remember the first dot-com bubble on like a professional level. You know, like I went to the launch parties of all these companies and then crashed and burned like X, you know, weeks later in many cases. So remembering that rise and fall, that like really just like imprinted on my brain, where I was like, okay, you know, these things can just like, you know, go up and down. And we've had some of that over this past period, but like not to that extent. Like it seems like even when there's been this retrenchment, it's kind of reinflated a little bit later. And your book starts out with a John Kenneth Galbraith quote about like financial euphoria and manias. And so there was part of me that's like I almost tweeted the Galbraith quote, but then I thought it's like, yeah, it's going to seem negative because, you know, like you do I think, so I'm going to ask you two, like WeWork generally speaking would be an emblem of systemic excesses that would be borne out in other companies. Like it's almost never the case that there'd be like one company that implodes to the tune of tens of billions and it would be alone. You know, like that's not a thing, you know, like you'd have to look around and be like, okay, there are these other companies. So do you think that, that people learned from WeWork and a couple of the other major companies, or do you think that, we're still kind of going to be experiencing speculative excesses in other areas?
I mean, they learned for like 5 minutes, it seemed like. And in the fall of 2019, after WeWork's IPO got called off, I mean, there was this like quick wake-up call. I mean, Masayoshi Son, the CEO of SoftBank, was going to raise another $100 billion fund. He was one of the biggest backers of WeWork. That fell apart.
Maybe the single biggest enabler. Like, if not for him, yes, like the story might be different.
Yeah, the rise and fall would have been much less dramatic. And so that was called off. Some other IPOs were called off. Masa, who had been telling entrepreneurs to be crazier, not just Adam Newman.
Crazier. That is the kind of mantra. And this genuinely is something that, you know, like, again, I struggled with it with reading your book. Was like, I'm like a very, very, you know, like, I think like a numbers driven, realistic guy. But there's something to craziness in this space. Like the craziness works sometimes.
Yeah. So yeah, the wake up call, Masa was starting to tell people to become profitable, like not to spend as much money. And then suddenly 2020, you know, after the pandemic, the Fed was sort of flooding the market with money and sort of swung back the other direction. And it's the only difference probably now is that a lot of, there's still a lot of capital in the private markets, but a lot of the insanity we're seeing in the public markets right now, companies going public with no revenue, with huge valuations, like this speculative frenzy definitely is still, the mania feels like it's still, we're in it right now.
Yeah, like I think there are, you know, at first there was a broad lesson, as Maureen was saying, that disappeared. But, you know, then there's a couple lingering lessons. Like, I don't think if you have a co-working company these days, you can really convince anyone that it's a tech company worth $47 billion. Like, I think that'll take a while to happen again. But yeah, like the general lessons, I think, were not long lasting at all.
This podcast is sponsored by ExpressVPN. Going online without ExpressVPN is like changing while leaving your window wide open. You might not have anything to hide, but why give randos a chance to invade your privacy? When you go online without a VPN, ISPs can see every single website you visit, and they can legally sell this information without your consent to ad companies and big tech, who can then use your data to target you and profit, not to your benefit, generally at your expense. So using ExpressVPN, it's like being a member of a high-tech company that's on your side, where they beam you into a server in another part of the world. No one can see anything you do. Just fire up the app, click one button, and you're beamed onto a completely safe, anonymized internet. They can't do anything with your data. I use ExpressVPN to have that peace of mind. To secure your online activity by visiting expressvpn.com/yang today. That's expressvpn.com/yang. And you can get an extra 3 months for free. expressvpn.com/yang.
So we're still in a mania, according to it sounds like both of you. There's clearly to me still a ton of excess in the market in various ways, and that was one of the jarring things reading your book was. Ordinarily, a book like this comes at like the end of a bubble, and then like things are, you know, are kind of like heading in the other direction. And I looked up and I was like, "Wait a minute! I think we're still in it. We're still the same bubble."
We had to rewrite the ending because that was the arc. It was like this was the punctuation on the era, because that's really what it looked like it was going to happen. And if you like all the big unicorns at the time had been deflated, like Uber or Lyft. To Maureen's point, like the market changed. So it was sort of a bit of a, you know, candidly, like it was a little shoehorning at the end. It's sort of like people learned a lesson and then they didn't. So nothing matters.
That was the vibe. I was like,
We wrote it like four times too. Because it was like, okay, maybe they learned their lesson, not totally. And then we're like, no, it's crazy. Like it has to keep on getting more extreme.
Brian Chesky from Airbnb goes on TV and is like literally speechless when he's told that what their opening share price is. And
Oh, I think that was actually one of the major signs that WeWork. I was like, oh no! Like when they started talking about like community adjusted EBITDA, like return on community, I was like, oh. like look away. so that should be one lesson, and this is a lesson from like the first bubble. As soon as you start making up new categories of numbers, everyone should just like start running the other direction.
there were a lot of, I mean, just sort of watching WeWork rise and then like sort of educating myself more about the .com era. It was like weird seeing all of these parallels where, like I was talking about Regis earlier, where this other office-based company in 2000 was telling everyone it was the future of the office, and a .com company because it had .com companies as users. And, then suddenly in the WeWork era, people are adding blockchain to the end of their name, just like companies would add .com. And it was just sort of this very like hype and speculative thing happening in the market sort of across a couple different categories.
It's something I struggle with sometimes. I mean, I haven't been paying attention to the market that much over this last several years because when I was running for president, I was like, I'm going to have like zero bandwidth for anything else. And so I just like ignored everything for a while. But like you look up and there are some experienced investors who are now saying like, hey, this is a bubble. Hey, this is going to be market correction. Hey, it's like I feel like we're in like the middle of like the never ending bubble. I don't know, and I have no idea how this story ends. No, like, you know, it's like and it's like the laws of gravity have stopped applying.
It's amazing because even like in the book, I forget if we put this, but one of the big investors, Benchmark, one of the big VC investors, Bill Gurley there, like he had this whole long treatise on the private market bubble. It's getting so dangerous, like 3 or 4 years ago. It's like there have been years of like, this is a bubble, this is scary. And then it just keeps on like getting higher with little blips, but not really. It's still going up in a pretty extreme way.
Then the second thing that happened with him, which I think is pretty representative, is, so I think he said that something like 2016. And then by 2018 or so, his line was, he was asked like, well, you used to be saying we were in a huge bubble and valuations have gone up. Where do we stand now? He's like, you got to just play the game on the field. Everything's crazy, but yeah.
That statement reminds me of what like the banker said around the financial crisis, where it's like, well, as long as the music's playing, you got to keep dancing.
Yes, totally.
Yeah, and you know, like to the credit of bubbles, real things get created that wouldn't have gotten created. You know, companies that are doing sort of like really crazy bets will start because there's so much money out there, and then they actually do figure something out that's really disruptive. So like there are some good effects to it too. But And then obviously the other thing that happens is companies like figure things out. I mean, you could easily have said, as most people did for years, that Amazon was absurdly overvalued. And then they like really do just kind of build a business. And then they also just kind of stumble into cloud computing that just spits out profit at them. So, I mean, these things do become real, maybe for other reasons sometimes.
So let's have a fun thought exercise. How well do you think that you know Adam Neumann after cataloging like the last number of years of his life? And what do you think is next for him?
I feel like I felt like I started to know him very well. I mean, you meet people from so many, we talked to so many people from so many different areas of his life. I'll say you feel like you just got in his head to a certain, we tried to. I'll just say on his next act, I've heard this from multiple people, that there will be a huge next act and it will be crazier than the first. So I don't know, Shark Tank, is he going to try to be prime minister of Israel? We hear that as like a real thing that he talks about. I don't know, another huge business. It will be something gigantic, grandiose.
There was another joke in the book that entertained me. So when I was running for president, we ran ads in Iowa, and I joked with my wife, Evelyn, like the ads had like images of the planet and the tides. And so I was joking that it looked like it was like Andrew Yang, Earth President, 2040. Like it was like came from like a planet far away. Like that was really the vibe of the ad. And like I was laughing when Adam talked about running for, what was it, Earth President?
President of the world.
President of the world, that was it. And I was like, look, you know, you can just take my ad. So second act for Adam, and you have to say, objectively, he's like a very successful entrepreneur in the sense that he founded a very significant company, you know, like it now has like, I guess, hundreds of millions of dollars personally. Like you read it and you're just like, I don't know whether to, I mean, you'd have to say like by any normal circumstance, he was very successful in the sense that most any of us would have like, you know, would love to have $1 billion like or whatever he personally has. Though obviously there's a significant black mark, you know, like about some of like the excesses.
Yeah, totally. I think that, you know, I guess the asterisk there is you know, WeWork was not a successful investment, right? I mean, it was for like a couple early investors, but in broad strokes, they took $11 billion or so and in investment and made an $8 billion company out of it, which over 10 years, which is not a great return on investment. You know, some of that went to Adam, right? Like, so he did, if the game is become really, really rich, he did an absolutely masterful job, because, you know, he essentially took investors' money and enriched himself in the end as that was the result. But if, you know, I guess this wasn't your argument, but there is a thought where people are like, well, WeWork's giant now. It's a great, you know, it's a real business, which it is true that it's a real business. But the reason it's giant is because it was subsidized by all this money that thought it was a software company.
Yeah, and the people I felt for were all the people who joined WeWork, believed in it, worked hard, thought that they were going to make a certain amount of money based upon their stock holdings, and then did not. I mean, I've led organizations. So when I ran a private company and we were acquired, like I gave people bonuses based upon the acquisition that actually they didn't have contracts for, but it was just like I just would have felt like a grade A asshole if people that I'd been working with for years did not get anything, you know, like based on the success of the company. I just thought that, that you know, that just would not have been a cool thing to do to people. So those are the people I feel for very deeply. You know, like you spend years of your life, in some cases work like extraordinarily hard and get nothing. Or, you know, or certainly like much less than you were promised or thought or whatnot. The interesting thing is like if you end up what you just said, Elliot, like you spend $11 billion to get $8 billion, like that objectively seems like a pretty bad investment, especially if it takes 10 years, because, you know, you could have done something else with the $11 billion and it would have wound up with, you know, but, like, something else. But then part of it is like, well, who's like the victim there? It's like the bonehead investor who gave you like the a lot of the $11 billion. And then it's like, should I care about that person's, you know, money? It's like, you know, I mean, and I like... Yes, in the sense that that money could have done something else, pretty much anything else, and would have been superior. Like, you know, and in my universe, it's like, you're just going to give it to random people. like, that would have been superior. So there's that, like the opportunity cost. But then there's part of me that's like, well, if I convince you to give me that much money and then I do something dumb with it.
Yes. Yeah, that's on them. I mean, yeah, I guess the only thing I would add is one of the victims that I try to fight for is reality.
Interesting. A champion of reality, eh, Elliot?
And I just think it's kind of dangerous for the system if you get this whole world of where the laws of gravity don't apply. So, like, what if the top five stocks in the stock market were all meme stocks, right? Like, what, you know, is that where we want our retirement? I mean, in the case of WeWork and you know, Uber, when it was at its real height in terms of just, you know, frothy valuation, they were essentially creating all of these offspring of people mimicking them under the sort of illusion that they were, those companies were worth much more than they sort of really were at the end of the day. And so that's why you had a million, the Uber for cookies and the Uber for pizza and Uber for valet parking that were all just like horrible businesses. And that's why, you know, you had this whole business of apartment rentals doing similar things like WeWork and, you know, Knotel is a competitor co-working space that went bankrupt. So like it, you know, that hurts more people too than just like the employees at WeWork who didn't get stock options.
Being a champion for reality, that I think that is like a pretty compelling case. I too approve of reality, but I think that this is really like the summary of why I felt this tension reading the book, is that I'm an entrepreneur who has fought for different things. Different times, like and sometimes you're arguing for like a different version of reality or a better version, like, you know, like I said, look, we should start giving everyone $1,000 a month, and on the face of it people are like, oh, like, you know, that's impossible or that's ridiculous, and then people are like, wait a minute, like, why could we not do that? And it's you know, and it's reality bending for a lot of people, or it was, and so pushing the boundaries of what reality is, particularly when it comes to capital flows, is something that, you know, like, I'm obviously into, like, I'm a champion of, but I also agree with you that, you know, like, I'm not for pulling the wool over, like, you know, like mass delusions. I'm not for mass. Like, so that was one of my struggles, really, you know, mm-hmm. reading this book and my feelings about Adam, who I don't know personally, but I know a lot of people who are in the same orbit. And so that there was part of me that's like, hero, like, you know, to be over simplistic, I don't think it's, you know, villain, you know, like, you know, and then there's like the system, and then you're like, well, you could definitely characterize the system as failing in various ways. And so this was just a personal struggle I had, reading the book as someone who's, like, built things that people felt were very, very unlikely before the fact, like that there's like a real, and I'm very proud of the things I've built. Like, I think that they've been good and positive. Like, I certainly, you know, like, think that if I'd been in that set of circumstances, I would have made very, very different decisions and tried harder to take care of various people. But that was one of the things I'm just sharing with you in like an entrepreneur's perspective, reading the book. And I don't know if that like sparks anything in terms of your experience writing it.
Well, I mean, one of the things, I mean, it brings up something that I think we've talked about a lot. And just in terms of the takeaway, it's like, who are the true victims? $10 billion, whatever, $11 billion was turned into $8. But like, what is the role of, like, what does it mean when a board of directors board of directors, they all abdicate their responsibility, or advisors, or lawyer, like all the people around him, this like sanctioned recklessness. I don't know. It's like, what, you know, when you brought up the financial crisis earlier, it's like there were obvious like victims and it spread, but it's like this, it was like a similar thing. Everyone was going after the riches, not dealing with anything. And fortunately the victims were fewer here, but it is like the system that creates the financial crisis, the system that creates WeWork, is all like people with a lot of money not doing what they should do when they have the power to change it. And I don't know, in this case, walking away kind of scot-free. It's like, you know, some people lost money, but they still have a lot of money. Moss is going to be fine. Adam's one
more of
the wealthier
fine.
People in the world. Yeah. I don't know. It just says something about that. It's sad.
that was like, that's true. It wasn't a Hollywood ending in that way where like you edit and be like, and everyone's fine.
Yeah, I think that, I don't know, it's the type of thing where it would be nicer if we had sort of a clearer lesson from everything, but it got very hazy. Yes, where like sort of the macro environment ended up bailing things out some. I think in terms of just like entrepreneurship, it's good to take big swings. Like that's kind of name of the game. The thing to keep in mind is just the scale, because like one of the, as a reporter who covers venture capital, like one of the sort of frustrating things that can always justify anything is like, well, we're not in the business of everything working out. We're here to take big bets, and 1 out of 10 can work out and it's fine. And it's like that type of reasoning justifies doing the stupidest things on earth, right? Like you could have, well, I want to spin a startup that spins straw and makes it into gold. And like, who knows, maybe it'll work. And so I guess it's the scale, right? Like, so if you're pumping $10 billion into a very clearly real estate company, that's a very different thing than if you're giving $17 million, which was the first big check that WeWork got, into a company that says they're going to do something big and has a really charismatic and hard driving founder.
That is a great point. And I was part of a venture capital backed startup, and I found it very difficult and frustrating because the CEO would essentially say, it's like, look, we have to grow explosively. We have to have very high margins. Like we have to take a big swing. And as a result, we were really undisciplined in our spending. And maybe because I'm like the son of immigrants, like I just had a really hard time with like us blowing money on stuff. like I just could handle it, and he had to explain to me the business rationale, which is like, look, like we've raised $7 million at a valuation of like, you know, 2022 or whatever. The only way anyone makes money is if we get to a valuation of, let's call it, 40 or 50 million. The only path to getting a valuation is like if we end up with this number of clients, so we have to like expand. like it was like this. That company did not work out. I learned a lot. But I think that there is something really important about trying to calibrate the amount of money for the task at hand, what you're saying, Elliot. And there were some investors who went to SoftBank and Mr. Sun, who are like, I want 75, and he's like, no, you want 300. You know, and if you are a smart entrepreneur, you're like, 300 million will break my company, because the only way I can justify it is if we, like, you know, grow extraordinarily fast and we're going to end up blowing money and like having a bad culture and all this other stuff. But I will say to you, like, if you're an entrepreneur and someone offers you the 300 million instead of the 75 million, like, you're going to take it. Like that, like, you know, to the extent that there was a problem in my mind, it was like it was the investors that were like offering the money, because I like to think if I was like a really great entrepreneur, I'd be like, I don't want the 300 million. I'm going to go someplace else. But in reality, if someone offers you that kind of investment, then you feel like you have to take it.
And he also would say he would give it to your competitors. That was the other threat. It was like, if you don't take the $300 million, I'll give your direct competitor $300 million.
Yes, it's that guy's fault. Boss Assad, he's like the embodiment of the excesses of the system. Well, congratulations on an awesome book. Again, I couldn't put it down. It is The Cult of We. So what comes next for each of you and the story? So this might be made into a movie. That's one thing we can look forward to. But yeah, like what's next for each of you?
I'll start. And to be clear, it wouldn't be the WeWork story is being made into a TV show, not based on us. But I'm sure they love our book. I don't know. I am these days writing about a lot of SPACs, a lot of electric vehicle companies with no revenue that are worth twice as much as Nissan. I've sort of always drawn to. I like to cover irrationality.
Elliot Brown, champion of reality. Keep an eye out. He's going to be like blowing the whistle on some other flim flam. So that's what's next for Elliot. Maureen?
I'm back at the Journal also. We're just, I'm looking at private capital markets, public capital markets, just kind of looking more broadly, just trying to find the next interesting story. And it just feels like, there's a lot of things to find. I don't know where, but I'm sort of excited to go back to the, drawing board and covering the kind of the insanity hasn't stopped, as we said. It feels like there's a lot to look for.
Well, this conversation has been a lot of fun, but it's also scared the shit out of me, I have to say. You guys have succeeded in scaring me about what's going on out there. Congratulations on an awesome achievement. Really happy for both of you. Everyone listening to this should check out The Cult of We. I promise you it's a phenomenal read. Keep fighting for reality and telling important stories out there. Appreciate both of you a great deal.
Thank you so much. Good luck with your book. Yes. And this is a really fun conversation.
Thanks, Andrew. Great to see you.